From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, a controversial sculpture in Overland Park has us thinking about nudity and art.
This particular statue in the children's venue went over the line and then needs to be brought back into an adult venue.
And we visit a local artist who's still grappling with the politics of his hometown.
It's just looking at where Jamaica's come from, and I always question, should Jamaica have gained independence back in the 60s?
It's game day for the Chiefs in Philadelphia. Meet a bar owner there who's obsessed with all things Chiefs.
It's just unique. It's the prettiest helmet. I mean, I'm not a red guy, but that helmet just works. It's just a beautiful helmet.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. This morning, a Kansas group is launching a petition to remove a statue from the Overland Park Arboretum. It's a bronze sculpture of a headless, mostly nude woman taking a selfie. Accept or Reject is the work of Chinese artist Yu Zhang. This is a second go-around for the petition against the sculpture. Last year, a grand jury dismissed the case after a one-day hearing. The American Family Association of Kansas and Missouri claimed that the Johnson County District Attorney improperly steered the jury and rushed through the process. The group successfully pushed for a new Kansas law, changing the way grand juries address petitions. So today, the American Family Association is once again gathering signatures to get the statue removed. Today on Casey Currents, we're going to talk about nudity and art through the ages and what's considered appropriate for children. But first, we talked to Philip Cosby, a spokesman for the American Family Association of Kansas and Missouri. He shares his group's perspective on the statue. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What exactly now has changed with the new Kansas state law that gives petitioners a greater role and a stronger role in this grand jury process?
Well, beginning with these are 15 people who are selected that really have no law enforcement or legal background, perhaps, for the most part. They're average people. But now they're randomly selected, not handpicked by the district attorney. The next one is when they come into that room, and those 15 people look at each other and say, gee, we're a grand jury. What is it we're supposed to do? That was usually the very vulnerable point at which the DA would walk into the room and say, hi, I'm here from the government. I'm here to help. And let me help you get you home quick, and we'll dispense with this. And usually that was the place where they said, gee, yeah, be our legal counsel. I said, okay, he would say, or she would say, and off they'd go. And the engineering of the outcome was set. Now, the law is that when those 15 people come into a room, that the first person that they must hear is the petitioner and their attorney, and to ask the question, why did you do this? Why the petition? What is the question before us? And we actually get to make our case, not just make our case, but also instill into them as to who they are. The historical significance of their autonomous, independent authority that is only second to the legislature, that no judge, no jury can walk in here or be present in this room unless you allow it, and that they get to understand that there was something wrong a year ago that the Kansas legislature saw, and they're going to shut the door on the DA, and they are authorized to hire their own independent counsel and their own independent investigators at their schedule, and that they can proceed with a thorough investigation and hear whomever they will as far as this case goes. And, of course, I, being the petitioner this time, would submit to them a list of witnesses, of subject matter experts in this case as far as early childhood development, law enforcement, the Arts Council people. And I had those before, but they were never heard.
I wonder what your sort of visceral reaction was to seeing the sculpture.
Well, it's a shocking piece. There's no doubt about it. This woman has been abused, cut up. I mean, she's physically cut. Her clothes are torn. It's a violent scene of this headless 9-foot bronze. The artist, the Chinese artist, does explain quite correctly that it is a broken woman, that she has lost her identity with her headlessness, and she's fractured and is in a very dark place, and she's showing herself to the world. Now, a seven-year-old can't quite wrap its mind around that kind of a concept, and it might have a teachable moment in an adult venue, where if you were to go and talk about the dangers of sexting and where it brought this woman to in her despair, but it's not something that you place in a garden where all the children are running up and down the paths and that they're shocked at what they're seeing as well. They're embarrassed by it.
And your petition says that the sculpture is obscene. And I wonder, under Kansas state law, what does make something obscene in legal terms or harmful to children?
Harmful to minors and obscenity. Well, the United States Supreme Court 1973 Miller decision kind of established that. You'll remember the judge said, I can't tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Right, that famous quote.
Now, it's a subjective call. And the Supreme Court said that every community will have a different standard called community standard. That San Francisco will have a different community standard than Abilene, Kansas. That a Mennonite community will be different than New York. So every community has the legal right to examine something of question in the midst of them, in the crucible of the courtroom, and ask that question, that gut question. Is this who we are? Is this just harmless fun? Is it legal pornography, or is it obscenity? So it's a very difficult sense in that you can't really put your hands on it in a mathematical equation as to what it is. But it is really what the law calls, and this is a throwback phrase, crimes against the public morals.
You mentioned this idea of a teachable moment. Some people who like the sculpture there in the park have said they want their children exposed to challenging art, and they'll have conversations with them about it. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, if this sculpture were in another place, in the Atkins Museum or somewhere of art, that a parent could go and talk to their kids about the dangers of sexting and express what the artist is saying in context, that would be, you know, perhaps of some value. You know, the human form is beautiful, as far as that goes. That's not the issue here. It's not the breast. It is the sexting act that is going on. It is the representation of the woman that has been decimated and is showing this decimation to the world. These are things that there is much more in this image, this particular statue, than just a nude woman. So it's a completely different thing as far as that conversation goes. I'm not being a prude here. I appreciate art. I appreciate the beauty of the human form. I do not appreciate sexting thrust in the face of our children and say, this is art. Appreciate it and understand it.
Philip Cosby is State Director of the American Family Association of Kansas and Missouri. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
You can see a photo of this sculpture at the Overland Park Arboretum on our website, kcur.org. And we're going to broaden our conversation now to nudity in art, how it's been received over the ages, and what's appropriate for kids. We got a few comments on our Facebook page. Carol says, leave it to Kansas to take us back to the 18th century. Kids see more nudity on TV than they will ever see in an art museum. And Denine says, my issue is that her head is lopped off and her middle is missing. The disjointed human form is jarring to me. Nude is nude. It's in galleries around the world. I just don't particularly care for this one. Joining us here in the studio is Robert Cohn. He's curator of ancient art at the Nelson Atkins Museum. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, Robert Cohn, you've just been working on the display of Fauno Rosso, ancient Roman satyr in Kirkwood Hall. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. We've been very, very lucky to get from the Capitoline Museums in Rome one of their most precious objects, and that is a sculpture of a, frankly, very drunken and very handsome-looking satyr. It'll be on display until September 29th, and it is shockingly beautiful. Wonderful piece.
And it is mostly nude?
Oh, it's, yes, actually it is very, very nude. Really is very much a celebration of the beauty of the human body and the attendant pleasures of it. It is certainly a very dramatic sculpture, all in red marble, and people tend to gaze at it for a long time.
Can you describe it a little bit more? It's
red marble,
but what is he doing?
Okay. Well, first of all, he's mostly human, but he's also a follower of Dionysus and has certain features of goat. So he has a goat's tail, and he also has dewlaps, and he's a very randy kind of fellow. And he's carrying with him some grapes. He's going to turn them into wine. He lifts up a cape, revealing his body. His hip is twisted to the side. The genitalia are dramatically portrayed with folds of flesh over them. And muscles, the quads, dramatically descending from the hips. It is an extraordinary image, and I must say that the back is probably twice as powerful as the front.
Huh. Now, I have heard that some parents are averting their kids' eyes as they walk past the sculpture. Does that surprise you?
Well, sure. It doesn't surprise me. And it's that's just part of kids growing up. And frankly, I was astonished at what a powerful work it is. So it's understandable, sure.
And how was nudity seen at the time that that sculpture was created?
Well, nudity... There's all kinds of nudity, aren't there? I mean, there is the, shall we say, erotically charged nudity, and then there is another kind of nudity that doesn't have such a strong flavor. And basically, in antiquity, especially in the Greek world, you find images of young men who are nude. Usually they're athletes. Sometimes they are civic leaders, and you find them in cemeteries. You find these images in sanctuaries. You find them in stadiums, in even civic centers, and indeed in imperial residences. So it was quite common in the ancient world.
And you do point out that there are all kinds, and the sculpture that we were talking about in the previous segment in Overland Park is making a particular statement with nudity, and throughout history, there are many messages that may be coming across through nudity, not just the celebration of the human form. I do want to introduce our other guests who are here with us, also from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, Adam Johnson, who's head of public programs there. Welcome, Adam.
And thank you, Sylvia.
And artist Karen Mathis. She curated a show last year called Body of Work of Images Depicting the Human Body. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Karen, I wonder, have you heard about this sculpture in Overland Park? Have you seen it?
Well, before I came on this morning, I did a little research on it, and in my search, it came up right away. All I had to do is, you know, type in statue in Overland Park, and it's, I guess, a big deal. I haven't seen the statue. I looked at it briefly.
And are you surprised by the reaction that you hear?
I'm a little surprised by it, but you know, I haven't seen it, and I don't know where it is in the sculpture park, and I don't know how big it is. So I think all those things would factor into, I think, a reaction to seeing the work.
Now, just to broaden that conversation, you know, has nudity always been a part of art, Robert?
For sure. And even in the third millennium, you find it. Even 35,000 years ago, you find great examples of it. So, yes, it has always been there.
And is it always about sex?
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, you have Michelangelo painting St. Peter in the buff in the Sistine Chapel, and certainly that's far, far from it. So a lot of times it just simply is a way of showing one's masculinity, one's power. In ancient societies, basically, these are militarized societies, and men must be in good shape because they will be at some point fighting for their lives and for their city. And so the celebration of the human body, particularly a very muscular one, that's very important.
Now, Karen Mathis, you curated an exhibit in Lawrence last year called Body of Work, Interpretations of a Live Model. You probably had a number of nudes in there, right?
Yes, we did, because we studied live models when we drew and painted from them.
And now, working with nude models is a standard thing for artists. Do they see naked bodies differently from the rest of us?
They might, only because they draw them so much that it is nothing to see, I think, a naked body. And I think the models are very comfortable with their bodies. And it seems nothing to us because we've drawn them so much.
But do you think artists realize that for those of us who don't look at naked bodies quite as much, that you know, we're not in middle school anymore, but still sometimes there can be a little surprise or shock or giggle?
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, that surprises me that people would be shocked by a body, because we all have them. It does shock me a little bit still that people have such a reaction to the naked body. It does surprise me.
Adam Johnson, I want to bring you into the conversation. Sure. as running public programs and you've worked with children at the museum. Does it surprise you that people react to nude bodies?
You know, not at all, actually. There's a whole range of reactions to the nude human form, just as much as there are humans and versions of the nude and naked body within an art museum or similar settings. So what we try to do when working with youth audiences is really actually first make allowances for the reactions that are really perfectly normal coming from a variety of audiences, including young children, middle school, and high school students as well.
How are the reactions different?
Well, you know, I mean, depending on, again, the level of comfort, the cultural beliefs, the understanding of the subject matter from the student's perspective coming into a place like the museum, the reactions really can be all over the place. Typically, what we often get is we'll often get kind of pointing, giggling, you know, something that kind of signals that this is a little bit unusual in terms of the children, their own life experiences.
And how do educators or parents respond to that?
Well, you know, what we do at the museum, our educators, our docents, and our teachers who work really closely with kids, really try to normalize the experience as much as possible. And kids often base their own reactions to subject matter like nudity based on the reactions that they see from their adult folks who are with them. So we really model a really kind of natural sort of understanding and awareness of the works, these works within the museum. And we also try to, as much as possible, really kind of set a certain expectation, letting the kids know immediately these will be on tour. You will see them. This is they are part of what we have in the museum. And if you'd like to talk about it, we can talk about it.
Robert Cohen, is you dealing with ancient art, I'm sure you come across nudes. You get used to it, too, like the artists who paint nude models often. Or you're looking at me a little quizzically. Maybe you don't get used to it.
Well, one never gets used to a great work of art, something like the Fauna Rosso at the Nelson. It is so shockingly wonderful that you always find something new and great about it. You never quite get used to a great work of art. Same way you never get used to a great play by Shakespeare. There's always something that draws you in, that surprises you.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk more about nudity in art and what's been acceptable over time in different cultures. You're listening to Casey Currents.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. A controversial sculpture at the Overland Park Arboretum has inspired our conversation today about nudity and art. With us in the studio are Robert Cohen and Adam Johnson of the Nelson Atkins Museum and artist and curator Karen Mathis. Robert Cohen, I wonder, what has been the reaction to nudity over the years? I know there's a broad span of history you could talk about, but there are cultures and times in which people have not wanted to see naked bodies.
Well, that's truly so. And at around the 3rd or 4th century AD in the Mediterranean, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean, emperors start putting back on their clothes. And so by the 6th century, it's impossible to imagine a emperor in the buff, whereas in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, there are plenty of examples of that. Huh. So there are dramatic changes
that
take place.
Is that because they had beautiful bodies before the 6th century?
That I can't speak to. But I suspect that with the Christianization of the Mediterranean basin, that a different attitude towards nudity begins to develop.
Mm-hmm. And what about in our era now? I mean, do you have a sense of what's acceptable in our culture? I mean, clearly this conversation happening means different people have different ideas about what's acceptable. What's your sense, Karen, of our era?
Our era is full of just different messages, I think, because I think I still see a little prudishness, but then you turn on TV and you see all sorts of things. So I think it's a lot of mixed messages. I don't think that you could probably give a blanket statement about what our era is like right now.
Adam, as you look through sort of history, what do you think?
Just going off a little bit about what Karen said about, the pervasiveness of the body in a whole host of contexts on the media, these really become teachable moments within certain settings, especially within an art museum, because there are different contexts which can allow parents with their children to really think about issues like, well, what's the difference between the way we see this body in this setting versus the way we might see a body on TV? So I think, there is a pervasiveness, and I think there is some discomfort with the subject matter within our own time. But I think those can really be powerful teaching moments for youth audiences.
Well, we have on the phone Morgan from Parkville. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, follow up with that teaching moment that I have two young children, they're 4 and 2, and we take them to the Nelson, probably a couple times a month, and we look at all the nudes and talk about how they have elbows, we have elbows, they have knees, we have knees, and yes, they have genitals and we have genitals, but we try to make it normal, and I think it's the not letting it be normal that is causing more of a problem. And I personally have no problem with nudity. I don't want my children to ever feel ashamed of their bodies. And I want them to realize that this is part of art and that's part of life and that it's something that we should value, not try to hide.
Adam, you have some thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with what you're saying. When the naked human body is something that is absolutely universal. Every single one of us in the world is naked at some point or another, and often multiple times a day. So with young children, especially, I think the caller's remarks are really good ways of engaging younger children with the issues of nakedness and nudity, and that is relating it to their own experiences, relating it to their own bodies, relating it to what is familiar for them in their experiences.
And now, we've been talking about art in a museum. Of course, there is public art too, and there people don't have really a choice. They haven't gone to the museum specifically to see it. Wonder if any of you have thoughts about the difference there.
I think that there are similarities within the setting, but I think that what can be the most challenging are the expectations that parents may have when bringing children to certain spaces. As I think was mentioned earlier in the program, there are expectations that when you do go into a place like the Nelson Atkins, there will be nudity in certain contexts, but maybe within other settings around the city, there is a surprise. And I think it's the surprise or the unpreparedness of it that makes sometimes the conversations between parent and child a little bit more challenging.
We have a call here from John in downtown KC Moe. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Great show today.
You have a question or a comment?
You know, yeah, I got a comment. Yeah, you know, or sort of question comment. I grew up in a evangelical household, and for us, you know, the human body was sort of taboo and forbidden to see. And I'm wondering how much that plays into, like, the over-sexualization of art today, even like the one in Overland Park, where it really was never that way throughout history, and how that sort of adds to our paranoia about, you know, the naked body and art.
You mean that adds to the over-sexualization on the part of the artist on the part of the viewer?
Just because it was so taboo and everything, that I feel like it created an over-sexualization of, you know, something that's beautiful, and now people, you know, parents have a fear of their kids seeing it because of how they were raised, but it's really not bad. If that makes sense at all.
On the part of the viewer, not on the part of the artist.
Yeah, on the part of the viewer, correct.
I think one thing that can be said about that is that what's important for people to know, and I think that often gets forgotten, is that the art itself is an inanimate object. It is just a thing. So the issues of nudity and the body are not from the object. They're actually from us when we engage in the object. So certainly cultural beliefs, sensitivities, that all play so much into the reception of works of art. For example, our education colleagues at European museums really don't have a lot of these. They don't really deal with these issues of nudity as often as we do. They're a little perplexed that in America these are issues. There's cultural differences there, and certainly the pervasiveness of the nude form across cultures also signals a variety of different responses.
Yeah, and in Europe and other parts of the world, you do see nudity even more on television and other places. Some people think we see it too much.
Yeah, and if I may add, you know, you have Michelangelo's David in the 16th century standing right in the middle of the heart of Florence. I mean, this was just something that was regularly seen by everyone.
Now, Karen Mathis, you curated this exhibit in Lawrence last year called Body of Work. And after the show ended in Lawrence, you were approached by an art space in Wichita to show it there. What happened to that show?
Well, it's interesting. They came to us and asked us to carry the show to City Arts in Wichita. And at the last minute, they got cold feet because there was partial nudity in some of the works shown.
And had you thought about how that nudity would be received by your audience in Lawrence and then by the audience in Wichita?
It was interesting. We just didn't think it was a controversial show at all. The intent wasn't for controversy. It was pretty much work just based on figure studies, basically. And, we were very surprised it was controversial at all.
And what do you think? Were there particular pieces that they were concerned about?
It's interesting. We had all of our images pre-approved by City Arts before they wanted a pre-approval. And some of the things that they had problems with were just like partial nudity, like from the back sitting down. They were not comfortable with anything that, you know, any sexual parts showing.
From the back sitting down.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
do you know what I mean?
Sorry. Are there things that you think about it as a curator, Robert and Karen, you curated that show too, about where you place nudes in an exhibit or maybe more charged pieces in an exhibit?
Well, you know, at the Nelson Atkins, we have this fabulous sculpture, the Fauno Rosso, this red satyr, basically right in the middle, in the heart of the museum. It's simply a magnificent work, and so we thought, put it in the best place possible. It wasn't an issue.
Wasn't a provocative placement?
No, it was a magnificent placement. It looks fabulous there, and that was the chief concern.
Now, in particular, I think in more modern contemporary art, there are pieces that use nudity in order to provoke, and that can even go towards what we might think of as pornography or violence. And I know that sometimes museums will place those in rooms behind curtains. I wonder if any of you can speak to the thought that goes behind that placement in museums.
Well, you know, at the Nelson, we actually don't conceal our works of nudity. For example, in the American Galleries, one of Kansas City's own great artists, Thomas Hart Benton, we've got the Persephone, which is a very provocative nude. She is taking the pose of a pinup, so there's something very eroticized about her form, but it takes point of prominence within the gallery it has. It has a host of really interesting issues, and when youth or family audiences see a work like that, it's really important to discuss it within its context. And one of the things that we find are, especially when works are contemporary, because all works of art are contemporary at one point in their history, that sometimes what is provocative lessens with time. So, for example, Thomas Hart Benton's Persephone is really sort of held aloft as this really fabulous, great work of art that doesn't tend to titillate as it might have done when it was first presented. So that's also an important issue to address with works.
You know, I just want to say something. As an artist, this is a little bit different than your question, but as an artist, when we're creating work, we don't want to think about the end, what happens after we're creating. We want to just create the best work that we can do. We don't want to worry if the work is going to be shown. Is it going to be sold? We just are concerned with the issues when we're working on it. Does that make sense?
That is mm-hmm. interesting, but sometimes things are intended to provoke, right?
Yes, yes.
And Robert?
Yeah, I think that so much of really great art is an examination of the human condition, of who we are. And, of course, one's instinctual life plays a tremendous role in our being. And I think art is a study of that, is a celebration of it, is an embracing of it. So it's in the museum.
And artists, I think, very well understand the how loaded the human body can be with cultural meaning. And sometimes they exploit it in provocative ways for a variety of reasons, not only for shock value, but sometimes to raise really important questions that they hope audiences ask amongst themselves.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about nudity in art. With us in studio, our arts educator, Adam Johnson, curator Robert Cohen, and artist and curator Karen Mathis. I am wondering to bring back, you mentioned the instinctual sort of part of us as humans, and maybe that's what makes people sometimes uncomfortable about when dealing with their children and dealing with their children's instincts and how their children react to things. I wonder, Adam, how do you sort of deal with that? I mean, a lot of people just don't want to tap into that.
You know, I think it's goes back to a couple of issues. One is the sort of normalizing. One is the reaction that the parents themselves have. If there's discomfort and quick movement away from something, sometimes it actually heightens a child's awareness of something. So we feel that really often dealing with the issue head on in an age appropriate manner is sometimes the best way to deal with the concerns or thoughts that we are most concerned that the children have. And sometimes it's more the discomfort of the parent dealing with the topic than it is the child's actual ability to handle the topic.
We have a call here, James in Olathe. Hi, James.
Hi, guys. Great show. Actually, you guys just touched on my point. I was going to bring up the fact that, you know, when you tell children they can't look at something, that's going to either make them want to look at it more or possibly think that something is wrong with it. I remember growing up as a child, we took many field trips in elementary school to the Nelson and saw many nude forms. But, you know, I just think that it's very important because it shows them that this is an art form. It's rather than in the media when human bodies are objectified. And the other thing I wanted to bring up, I don't know if anyone remembers, but I want to say it was ABC back years ago showed Schindler's List uncut, and there's plenty of nudity in it simply because it was an art form.
On Schindler's List? I'm sorry?
Yeah, yes, on Schindler's List. That was shown on primetime public television.
Huh. And yeah, getting into nudity in films and on television is a whole other, I think, can of worms. Except that that's one of the main ways I think that that sometimes we see these images and then we bring that experience with us when we go to the museum or see public art. I wonder what you think about sort of how that influences how we see art, just what we're used to seeing on television or movies or all those images.
Well, I think it does, in fact, impact how the response to nudity happens. I think it does elicit some of the giggles that we often hear in the galleries, both from adults and youth audiences. So, but I think, again, that context that we often experience nudity, either through film, through media, through television, and then the sort of very different experience when approaching a work of art in a variety of different contexts, again, is just such a great moment to then really reflect back on how the nudity is experienced within the media. So, and sometimes you can't really do that until you experience nudity in a completely different form.
We have a call from Mike in South Kansas City. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I was just going to comment. When I was in college, I wasn't going there, but I had friends going to the Art Institute, and I went down there, and they were they had some nudity, you know, painting, and you know, and that's why we went down there. So, but in our immaturity, but my point is, you know, in so much of the art, they're not Playboy bunnies. They're pleasantly plump, and I'm talking females, pleasantly plump, and I could see a child going and seeing art and seeing and relating a lot to when they've seen their parents nude, you know, getting dressed or, you know what I mean, around the house.
Well,
and that's my comments. Uh-huh. I'm just going to hang up and shut up.
So thank you, Adam.
You know, in that scenario would be, I mean, how great would it be to look at one of those pleasantly plump works of art and then ask the child, well, think about the models, the half-nude models that you see in magazines on a daily basis. What's the difference? Why has the artist chosen to do this? Why do you think we tend to look at the nude female form within these contexts? So it's again, a great teachable moment.
Well, it's interesting that he also says that nudity is what draws people to art sometimes. Makes it fun.
I'm really glad he liked the work.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. Adam Johnson is head of public programs at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Robert Cohen, curator of ancient art at the Nelson Atkins Museum also, and has been working on that Fauno Rosso that is in Kirkwood Hall right now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Karen Mathis, artist and curator, thank you for sharing your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up after the break, we meet a bar owner in South Philly. He's not from KC, but he loves the Chiefs and is hosting a block party for the game tonight, deep in Eagles territory. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Artist Paul Anthony Smith is riding the wave of early success. Just a few years after graduating from the Kansas City Art Institute, Smith was invited to do a one-person show at the Zier Smith Gallery in New York. And recently, he was listed by the Huffington Post as one of America's top 30 black artists under 40. His paintings take a fresh look at the lives of everyday people in his home country of Jamaica. Casey Current's Susan Wilson went to talk to Paul Anthony Smith about his work at his studio and home in the Crossroads Arts District.
Paul Anthony Smith greets me with a warm smile in front of his studio in the Crossroads District. He has a smooth mahogany face and short dreadlocks sprouting from the top of his head. His studio is bare bones, a couch, a chair, and a desk, but the walls are nearly covered with canvases. These are his works in progress.
I think of them as kids.
Smith's art often focuses on images of family, like a large painting of his grandmother Isilda, who passed away.
I do miss her, and it's that painting was a way of looking back at her. At the time, it was also meditative and is commemorating her life.
Politics, class struggles, and history are also recurrent themes in Smith's work, like his piece Norman Manley's Cabinet. It's an homage to the men who established Jamaica's first political party, each wearing a shiny balaclava or ski mask. Manley led a hard-fought battle for Jamaica's independence from the British and the Spanish in 1962 and later became prime minister.
Jamaica's history, the past of Jamaica, religious Rastafarian culture, creates the current people. I feel like a lot of those people there in Jamaica, even though it was once a big tourism industry, I think the tourism industry has gone down since I left there back in the 90s. And the economy is going down. And it's just looking at where Jamaica's come from. And I always question, should Jamaica have gained independence back in the 60s.
Paul Anthony Smith grew up in a town called Port Antonio in Jamaica. He moved with his family to Miami when he was 9. Smith credits his mother for recognizing his interest in art and nurturing it throughout his childhood.
She supported me in those days. You know, if I needed some pencils, crayons, watercolor, whatever it was, I remember that my mom was always there. If I asked her for it, she'd get it for me because she knows that's what I want to do after school.
His father always wanted him to become an architect, but Paul Anthony Smith ended up at the Kansas City Art Institute. Eager to show his dad what he was up to in art school, Smith sent him a print he had done of the Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, who is revered in Jamaica as a symbol of Rastafarianism.
You know, my dad never really looked at my work, and this was the one point that I really wanted him to, like, see that, oh, hey, I'm using something of his interest. But the way how I worked with this piece is that I somewhat defaced the image, putting a balaclava mask over this guy's face and mailing it to him, you know. And he had a negative reaction to it and thought I was very disrespectful. But you know what? You have to do these things in life for someone to... You have to get their attention somehow. And this was my way to get his attention. Because he's kind of ignored my work for a number of years. And you know, it's okay. I just laugh at it at times.
The Haile Selassie print features a signature technique that Smith uses in many of his pieces called picotage. It's an 18th century French technique of making holes into a pattern on an image. He uses the technique to tear the surface of scanned photographs, making them glittery. They shimmer with an eerie glow and a sense of mystery. His piece, Non-Tourist Location, features Jamaican men sitting on a curb, their faces and bodies glistening with picotage markings.
I'm using a ceramic needle tool. It's like going back to ceramics and removing the surface layer of the paper, which I'm picking at to create this tear in the surface. It's kind of like scarification and modifying the images that I'm picking away at.
In addition to picotage, Smith is known for his ceramic sculptures, perfected during a ceramics residency in Colorado. There he crafted large ceramic figures of tarmac workers, people who work near the runways at airports, who are recurring characters in his work. The tarmac workers are Smith's way of saying that the lives of everyday people, like the working class family he comes from, are significant.
They make up the larger community that helps with the tourist that comes into the country. But it's also, they make up the infrastructure of how the country's economy. These are people that are overlooked, but they're always necessary for us to go and enjoy ourselves that we overlook. And I always like these guys.
Making a living as an artist is something many struggle for years to accomplish. Rochelle Smith, executive director of the H&R Block Art Space, met Paul Anthony Smith, no relation, early on as an art student.
He's very inspired by visual culture and images that we find and see in the media, but I think he's also interested in mining his own history and the history of his family and from where they come from.
She says this is subject matter that lots of contemporary artists are dealing with, but Paul's approach is innovative.
I think Paul's really exploring those traditions, but doing it with new materials and new ideas, and that's pretty exciting.
Examples of this are seen in works like The Queen, a portrait of Queen Elizabeth, a prominent figure during Jamaica's independence. Smith covers her face in a picotage pattern, leaving only the eyes, and a porcelain relief work where he merges his face with political figures, entitled Paul Lincoln, Paul Obama, and Paul McCain.
I made those during the 2008 presidential election. And again, I think I was looking at the histories of the black people in America, not African Americans in general, but just like the black people and where we've come from as a nation. In those pieces, I created my faces within them just to, you know, have like a self-reflection of where I see myself in them. Who do I believe in? Who do I trust at the time?
Smith is known for covering the faces of his subjects with masks, like the piece called Roz, meaning king. It features a mask from the Congo, embellished with picotage or other decoration. Smith meticulously researches the ceremonial purpose of each mask. Locally, this piece interested the Nerman Museum, who purchased the work for its collection.
Mask disguise the figure, allowing them to be free.
Freedom to create is what drives Paul Anthony Smith's work. From masks, picotage, ceramic sculpture, and painting, he says that there should be no limitations on how an artist expresses his ideas. Paul Anthony Smith, only 3 years out of art school, is busy creating work for the Charlotte Street Foundation Visual Artist Award exhibition in November, as well as an upcoming show in the McKinney Gallery in Dallas. For KCUR, I'm Susan Wilson.
And to get away from art for the end of the show, the Chiefs are gearing up to play in Philadelphia tonight. It's kind of an awkward homecoming for their former coach, Andy Reid, who was with the Eagles for 14 years and fired last December. But there's at least one spot in the heart of South Philly where Reid definitely won't get booed. It's Big Charlie's Saloon, which is the home for Chiefs fans in Philadelphia. And they're mostly not Kansas Citians. We called up owner Paul Stako to find out how he got obsessed with the team.
My father actually had the bar, and he passed away in 83, and then I took over. And I was actually watching the games back at a bar with me and maybe three, four guys. And then over the years, people just came in the back and watching the games with us. They seen our passion, and then, you know, they actually stood. And then it went from 5 to 10, and then over the years, it just went, you know, went crazy.
Was your dad a Chiefs fan?
No, he wasn't. I mean, he bet them in the Super Bowl back in the day, 1970. In 1971, I wound up getting a bike out of the deal. And so I was loyal to the Chiefs just for that. I knew that team did good for my father. And, you know, and then I fell in love with their helmets. I loved the helmet, and that was it. I always stood with them. You know, I stood by them.
What do you love about the helmet?
It's just unique. It's the prettiest helmet. I mean, I'm not a red guy, but that helmet just works. It's just a beautiful helmet.
And so were you the one that changed it to made it into a Chiefs bar?
Yeah, little by little. I mean, I didn't really do it specifically to be a Chiefs bar, but one helmet went to two helmets, and then the back went a little bit into the front, and then it just, you know, just went from there. I didn't really intend to do it that way.
So you've got a lot of memorabilia there.
Yeah, I got a lot.
What kind of things?
Well, I got mini helmets, big helmets, real helmets, jerseys. I got pictures. And I would say 85% of it is all gifts to me. My my mom, God rest her soul, any birthday, she'd buy me something with the Chiefs. My sister the same way, my girlfriend the same way. Everything's always, you know, any holiday, you know, Christmas, I get automatically, I get Chiefs stuff. So I just, you know, I don't really have to buy anything. I usually get it for gifts.
So how'd you find other people who are into the Chiefs? I mean, did you convert them or, you know, how do they find you?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you go in the back and you watch the game, when you watch the games with us, it was like four or five of us, it was just contagious. And some people that really had no favorite team, and, you know, they would come in the back and see that, and the next week they'd have Chiefs stuff on. And that's how we went from, like, you know, like five of us, like I said, to, you know, just boomed. And now it's like there might be 40 of us that are steady. Now you got 40 of us. And then you got plus maybe another 20 that come by from different neighborhoods, like, you know, maybe from Jersey, Delaware, a couple guys from New York. So that's how that started.
And is anybody from KC?
Yeah, a few people. A couple guys actually moved from KC to Philadelphia. Yeah, and they come in, they heard about the place. And then once you come in, I mean, I think people liked it, that the fact that there's never no trouble. There's, you know, people can actually relax. So you watch a game, anybody, you know, root for any game you want. There's games in the front. There's four or five different games.
So the Chiefs fans go to the back.
Yeah, they come in the back, yes.
So I understand things are pretty busy over there today. You're setting up.
Yeah, it is. We're going to tailgate. We're going to start about 2 o'clock. We close the street off. We have a band coming. We're barbecuing. And we're expecting about 100 people.
And you call this your Super Bowl?
Yeah, I think so. I do. I think it's a big deal for our guys to be like, you know, we're getting talked about a lot as far as on the local stations. We're in the middle of South Philly, and we're surrounded by Eagle fans. Now, this is our neighborhood. This is our, so we don't get a hard time that way. But there's back and forth bickering. So we like to have bragging rights on them. Huh. We really like to get the game. We have a lot of people coming coming by. So, you know, it's going to be a big deal.
Only Chiefs fans?
No, I'm sure it'll be Eagle fans floating by. I mean, we're cordial. There's no problem. As long as they know how to act, we definitely know how to act. As long as nobody gives us a hard time, we're not going to give nobody a hard time.
What usually happens at Big Charlie Saloon when the Chiefs and Eagles play?
Well, they don't play often, but when they do, I mean, the last couple times, they got the better of it. And so we had to hear some yapping, but it was all fun. Mostly the yapping's coming from friends of ours, huh. You know, neighborhood guys that are Eagle fans. No strangers are coming in and bothering us. It's basically our friends.
And, of course, Andy Reid, the longtime coach of the Eagles, is now coach of the Chiefs. People are thinking the Eagles might boo him in the stadium, the Eagles fans.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, I heard that.
How will he be received at your bar?
Oh, no, he's one of us. Once he put on the red hat, you know, once he signed up for us, you know, he was part of our family. That's how we felt. You know, we support him 100%.
So that was the talk at the bar when you heard Reid was hired by the Chiefs?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a couple guys that didn't know how to react because, you know, he was an Eagle. And, you know, he was an Eagle for 14 years. And then when he came to Kansas City, a couple guys didn't know how to react. My reaction was, I'm on board. Let's go. You know, let's start winning. You know, and that was it. I was on board with it.
Now, last year was a pretty tough year to be a Chiefs fan, even
for
here
sure.
In KC. Wonder what it was like at the bar.
It was somber. It was, after the first week, we had, a big crowd. It cut in half the following week. And by October, it was just a few of us, you know, just the hardcore guys, the old-timers that were just here. And we were basically just watching it like, you know, but it wasn't fun watching it, put it that way.
Do you feel more hopeful for the Chiefs this year?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I was actually watching a game with a kid for maybe 5 years, and I haven't seen him smile like I did the first 2 weeks in 5 years. I didn't really realize he had teeth in his mouth until this year. I looked over, he was smiling. So I was like, you know, it's been a big difference this year.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us and have fun.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Paul Stako is owner of Big Charlie Saloon, a Chiefs bar in the heart of South Philly. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
The Chiefs play the Eagles tonight at 7:25. Thank you. That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast will be every Thursday morning from now on. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kcurrents. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Suzanne Hogan, Alex Smith, and Susan Wilson. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky, Esther Honig, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.